Hello and welcome. I'm Barry Winbolt and this is Get a Better Handle on Life. Do you ever feel that life's a bit difficult? Do you find yourself struggling to keep up with all the demands of your daily routine? Well, you're not alone. There are literally hundreds of challenges we have to tackle in life, and we're often unprepared. That's why I produced this podcast. Experience has shown me that faced with a challenge, people often struggle simply for the want of a starting point. After 30 years as a psychologist, therapist, and coach, I know that with the right tools and strategies, you don't have to struggle. At least you can live more fully despite the problem. At least that's often the case. Today, though, something a little different. Recently, I was invited to speak at the Stop Depression Summit. So in this episode, the roles are switched. I don't have a guest, I am the guest, and I'm being interviewed speaking about what I've called the logic of depression. And by the way, the interview is in the capable hands of Monica Martunovic.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Stop Depression Summit. My name is Monica and I'm your co-host of the summit. Unfortunately, depression is incredibly common nowadays, and we are holding the summit so that everyone has the opportunity to really understand how to improve their condition. But even when the person's condition rapidly deteriorates, that person is not in a hurry to ask for help from a specialist. Now, why does this happen? And today with this topic, we have an incredible guest. Barry Winbolt will help us to understand why so many sufferers refuse to get help. Barry is a psychologist and a brief therapist in private practice in the UK. He has specialized in the treatment of depression for over 25 years. Barry, thank you so very, very much for being with us here today. Welcome.
It's my privilege and I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. It is wonderful to have you here, Barry. So can you help us understand why and what are the reasons why people actually refuse to get help?
Well, there are many, I think. And I'm speaking as somebody who has twice in my life have to live with people who suffered from serious depression, perhaps one might say for good reason, but also from my training as a therapist and also personal experience, because as a young man, I wasn't a lot of fun to live with because I had bouts of depression. So that's the first thing I'd say. Those are my kind of qualifications from both sides of the fence, so to speak.
Yes.
I think the first thing we have to understand about depression is it's an individualistic condition. Depression is just an umbrella term, but it affects everybody slightly differently. I was once taught that as a therapist in my training that whenever I was dealing with somebody with depression, I would be creating a new form of therapy for that person. And that's proved to be really good advice. And there are also specific approaches one can use, of which more later. But I think it's important to say, if you're dealing with somebody with depression, or if you are feeling depressed yourself and suffering from depression, it's a mood disorder, and that colours your judgment. That's the first thing it does. And you won't be believing, probably, that help is out there. That's one common reason that people tend to say to me, well, why would I get help? I know what my problems are. And so it's a multifaceted answer. I think on the one hand, there's the individual's mindset about their condition, but also the beliefs about what help is, what it might feel like, look like, what might happen, where to go, and all of those things. But for me, the biggest single contributor, and I've looked at this very closely for a long time in people, is what I call the logic of depression. Depression brings with it, if we're using an umbrella term, brings with it a certain mindset linked to what's known as our attributional style or our explanatory style. And that mindset, if I'm feeling depressed, is going to tell me that things are pretty bad, they're not likely to change, it's all in me, I can't be helped. So in other words, any suggestions coming from outside, or I might see a TV program or read an article in a magazine or online, I'm going to be filtering how this applies to me through this, what I'll essentially call a depressive, the logic of depression. And that's going to influence how open I am to seeking help in very short, it's kind of a short answer, but right. I think right. what I'd say is, in summary, the logic of depression defeats us in our attempts to look elsewhere, because it's just telling us, you needn't bother, you can't be helped, it's all about you, and so on and so forth.
Right, right. You explained it so incredibly well, Barry. And one thing that stood out to me from what you just said is that you said that there is no kind of cookie cutter way to deal with depression for every single person, right? So how important is that?
Vital. Mm-hmm. Vital. If I come into you, if I'm suffering with depression, and I come to you as a family member or even as a professional, it's critical, that first conversation. You know, it's really critical that I feel I connect with you and I feel understood, and that I don't think that you are kind of staring over my shoulder out of the window or looking at your watch. And believe me, I have heard this from clients about therapists. It's quite worrying, the level of rejection of therapy in clients because they've had a previous negative experience. So that first few minutes is really critical. And as a guideline to anybody watching, I would say, you know, I always say, sometimes relatives ring me up and they say, well, I'm really worried about my husband, son, wife, whatever. And I'm always a bit saddened by that because I want to speak to the person, not a relative. But what I say to them is, look, all you can do, don't, whatever you do, say, will you go and see a therapist? I say, will you have a conversation with this guy? That's all you're committing to is one telephone conversation or one Zoom call for 5, 10, 20 minutes. Now, in my experience, for the years I've been doing it, only about twice in over 25 years have I had somebody who hasn't followed on from that initial conversation. So if they've said yes to a conversation, they've kind of got a toe through the door. They're open to a possibility, but they don't feel they've committed to something longer. And there are images out there of therapy lasting many years, many months, that type of thing. And that's not the case in the way I work or peers, colleagues of mine work. And incidentally, although all forms of therapy tend to have roughly the same outcomes, there is by no means a link between a long-term problem requiring a long-term solution. You know, I see clients, generally speaking, clients suffering with depression for under 10 sessions. And other guidelines say between 10 and 20 sessions. But, you know, if it's effective, if it's working, people can get back on their feet, so to speak, and start noticing improvements and building on that very early on.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating, Barry, to hear you say these things, and also so very encouraging that people can actually start with these small mini steps. That is not a huge commitment to them.
No.
So they can start with perhaps 1% of that hope, and as you said, they go on, don't they?
Yeah. And I, you know, they don't always come back immediately, but I just say, look, it's just about a conversation. Forget the word therapy, coaching, whatever you want to call it. It's about a conversation between human beings, because what, as individuals, we cannot do, we cannot think in the same way when we are alone, in the way that we think when we're engaged in a conversation, such as you and I are having now. You know, it becomes a meeting of minds. It becomes two minds become something much greater than the sum of their parts. Mm-hmm. And my thinking begins to change because of what you're saying to me, and your thinking begins to change because of things I'm saying. And it's not great insights or anything like that. It's just that our minds work differently. We're social beings.
Yes.
And this is a moment of great hope in helping people. But it's that first obstacle of resistance. Yeah. So anything we can do to help people take that step is useful.
Yeah. Is it like approaching it in a very personable way? We're not like divorcing ourselves from, oh, that's just a client. That is something that we cannot really touch, that we cannot really imagine or put our hands on. It's a person, right?
I think you've hit it on the head. That is absolutely mm-hmm. what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one is so engaged in that relationship with that client that, in my case, that actually it becomes a living and very interesting conversation. Even depressed people I work with, people severely depressed for maybe 10, 20 years, we usually start laughing within about half an hour. Now, when somebody has laughed once, they cannot go out there and say all of life is bad.
Right.
You know, even if we've only had 2 minutes, because curiously, when one is engaged in a conversation you feel safe with and you feel the process is going forward and you know there's no commitment, nobody is saying to them, you're going to have to leave this depression behind. Why would they? They feel safe with it. That's the last thing I try and do is take somebody's symptoms away. They're absolutely free to keep them. Mm-hmm. And it's very important to recognize that. You know, another thing I was told, I can't remember, years and years ago when I was training, don't be too quick to take your client's symptoms away from them. You know, they've had them for years. They need them. They support them. It's their safe place, even though it may not be comfortable for them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is a reason why they're there in the first place, right? So what I wanted to ask you, Barry, is, you know, what you just said, it kind of closely related to this idea of friendship, of being close. So is it important to kind of have this friendly approach, not only with our potential future therapists and people, but is it important to have this just a normal conversation, a true, deep, open conversation with people around us that might suffer with depression?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. As I've said before, we are social beings, you know, so we have to connect with people empathetically. And you can't do that hiding behind a mask of fear, because I'm afraid of talking to you about your symptoms, for example, or a professional mask. A lot of therapists I know feel safe like that.
Yes.
And many are trained. I was originally trained about distance and not sharing my personal life. But I totally disagree with that. I think that is wrong. And I didn't get that idea myself. I've been trained by some very great people in my time. But you can't hide behind a facade.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course we have to protect ourselves. Of course we have to be careful that we, the therapists, don't overcommit on a personal level, or we don't break any certain ethical guidelines or rules. But we should feel safe enough to have the sort of conversation I'm talking about when I'm training people is the room disappears. You forget where you are. The only thing in that conversation is the two people in the room.
Right.
And I think the clients that I work with get that. And I think it's very important to have that humane and humanistic approach first and foremost. It depends on the clients. You know, some people I have to take a slightly more distant perspective because I think they expect it, because I feel I need to do that for whatever reason. You know, they're not my friends, but certainly my conversations with clients tend to be pretty social and realistic and about real life.
Right.
But that's a personal approach. That's just how I approach it, you know.
Of course, of course. And I'm sure that your, you know, approach has been incredibly effective, as people can feel that realness and perhaps connect with you in such a way that is very effective. But what I wanted to ask you also, have you encountered people in your professional life dealing with clients and talking to them that they themselves perhaps have this mask of fear, that they themselves need to present something and it's not really true?
Yeah. You've just described my worst fear about myself. Mm-hmm. You know, that sometimes I don't see the mask. That 4 o'clock in the morning the next day I wake up wondering what I missed.
Right.
And sometimes that can be quite hard to break through. And I think it's very important. Maybe I shouldn't use the word breakthrough because it's not, kind of, that sounds a little bit assertive, but to see behind it. And of course, as I said earlier, depression is a very individualistic set of symptoms. So maybe that's okay. Maybe we don't have to go behind the mask if the person is comfortable, feels more comfortable like that. But we certainly can't challenge it or push through it. We have to wait for the you know, the real person to come out. But maybe it's not always necessary either.
Yes, I understand. I understand. Well, you know, we also talked about the importance to ask for help before. So how important is it to ask for help on time? Is there a time limit, Barry?
I don't know that there's a time limit. I mean, I have met people who've suffered with depression for 30 years or more. And I'm asking people more about what it is they want to change. If, for example, I met somebody 3 days ago, socially, who I think was in a high state of distress and was doing a lot of what I'd call window dressing. There was a lot of display behavior going on, and yet she was talking about problems, very personal problems, inappropriately, I felt, for the setting. And so I picked up on that distress, but who can say what would have been the right time? Because she sounded to me, she had an answer for everything. This was not a candidate. I certainly wasn't going to speak about what I did, but I was just observing this. But the person has to be ready in themselves to some degree. They also have to understand they may not be completely ready. There's going to be discomfort. Any personal change brings discomfort. Otherwise, it's not personal change, because instinctively we don't like change. So taking that step is important when it's right for the person.
Right.
I was working with a man very long time ago, right at the beginning of my career, this career, and he was elderly, and he always wanted his wife in the room with him while we were doing the conversations. And I wasn't very keen on this, but he insisted, and so she stayed in the room. And the reason I wasn't keen on it was because I won't go into that now, but I felt it wasn't the best thing for him. And at the end of the conversation I was having with him, just as he was getting ready to leave, she leant forward and said, "You see, he's telling you, you can lead a horse to water." And he turned to her and said, "Well, I was once told the horse has got to be thirsty." And I've always remembered that. And what he was saying, I think, was like, yeah, okay, we have a saying in English, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. Yeah. But really, in my professional repertoire, the thing is to create thirst, and then the horse finds the water by itself. Yes. Of course, my clients aren't horses. I have to say that these days, but you know. So I think the key thing is, in answer to your question, what is the right time? The right time is when the person feels it's right for them. But I would be saying they have to consider not just themselves. You know, quite often people suffering with mood disorders will think that they're the only person in the frame, and then they're the only person that is a problem, but it's going to be affecting other people's lives. And one very famous psychologist, Jordan Peterson, once said, you know, if you are suffering from depression and somebody throws you a lifeline, I'm paraphrasing him, but and he used an expletive, which I won't use, but he said, you'd better jolly well take it. So if help is offered, he was saying, and I agree, as a person suffering from depression, you won't be affecting only yourself. You have a responsibility to those around you to seek help. Now, I know a lot of people are uncomfortable with that word responsibility, but that is my position, that really it's unfair on others.
Yes.
And it ends a lot of relationships.
Yes, absolutely. Is it because depression causes you to feel very low, and therefore you kind of pull others or influence others down with you, or They give all their resources to make you feel better. How does that work, Barry? Can you explain it to me?
All of the above, I would say. All of the above. I mean, first of all, in my own case, from when I was a very young man, living with a depressed person isn't a bundle of fun. You know, I would periodically shut myself off. And I would say to people, look, I'm okay, just stop bothering me and I'll be all right, I'll get through this. And I did. But meantime, they're around me worrying. My family is worrying. And also remember, depression takes many forms. So it disturbs people's sleep. You might be disturbing your partner's sleep. It wears people down. It puts people more at risk of physical illness, more at risk of accidents, more at risk of... It creates all sorts of other vulnerabilities. And we live in a social world. We have to keep ourselves on track and keep ourselves functioning well, so that we don't put others at risk or worry others or use up their resources.
Right, right. This also almost reminds us in a way that we're kind of all part of one, as if we're a cell of one organism or one thing. So if one doesn't work very right or very correctly, let's say, and I'm using these words very crudely, perhaps not working, functioning, existing in their fullest potential, then the others around them are also suffering. Is that what you're saying, Barry?
I can't guarantee that others are suffering. And by the way, I don't think your language is crude at all. I think it's very refined in this respect, and you're describing it very well. But I think that, I would say that because we are all connected, there will be others worried about us. And there will also be a risk that we're performing below par, even if we don't recognize it. And there's nothing wrong with that from time to time. We shouldn't feel ostracized or isolated because we know we're not functioning well. But we should be able to connect with others and hold ourselves to account enough. Mm-hmm. But I recognize this is an ideal because most people, depressed or not, don't hold themselves to account enough until something happens. Mostly we don't do that. We think about life out there. It takes a long time to kind of register that we are responsible for more than just ourselves and our own lives, in life anyway. And then if on top of that you have a mood disorder, you hardly feel like saying to yourself, oh, well, I better get up and pull myself together today. So what we can do is learn a few tricks and tips and skills to kind of get us up and moving. And then hopefully, you know, if we feel we can't do it by ourselves, we go and find somebody who we feel can help us, a professional, I mean.
Right. This is so beautifully said, Barry. And I'm sure that our audience is really absorbing every word you're saying. So this is amazing. And what I wanted to, let's say, draw attention to, I know what you just said, but what if a person doesn't really feel worthy of help, doesn't really feel that I know that they're like, perhaps, oh, there is no help for me. But what if they say, I don't think that there is for me, and I don't deserve it? What do they do in that position?
Very good point. You see, we come back to the logic of depression. Mm-hmm. And I've written on this, it's on my blog. And we have to learn not to trust our thinking when we're depressed. We have to treat it like an unreliable friend. You know, if you have a circle of friends, and maybe you don't recognize it at first, but eventually you notice that one person in the friendship group is actually, maybe what the way they're behaving towards you isn't helping you in life. You know, and we come to mistrust them. Mm-hmm. And we don't hang around with them so much, or we don't take their words too seriously anymore. Well, I think that's what it's like with the thinking that goes with depression. We have to mistrust it.
Yes.
And if I don't feel worthy, well, I don't have a simple answer to that. That's about my sense of, and by the way, I might feel guilty. That can be another situation. A lot of people express guilt or shame. And these are all very important factors in how the person values themselves and in their identity and how they believe they are in the world and their potential, which of course feeds straight back into depression.
Right.
And so it does that answer the question?
Yeah, of course. Of course it does. I just wanted to say you literally just answered it very, very well. So one more thing that I kind of wanted to piggyback on that is this idea of, okay, so we're suffering with depression, or people that we know around us are suffering with depression. And if we're just a normal person and not a therapist, how can we approach this in a sensible, sensitive way, let's say? How can we be more useful to that person and to ourselves as a community?
Yeah. The first thing I would say is look after yourself. If you've lived with somebody who is suffering from depression for some time, you may be a little impatient with them. This is completely natural. Frustrated because you love them, you care for them, you know that they are capable of more and so forth. So for very genuine and sincere reasons, we can get a little frustrated. So we need to look after ourselves. We need to get respite regularly and not get sucked into that depressive kind of vortex that keeps us stuck in that spot all the time, 24/7. You know, so we have to do our own things. We have to give ourselves permission to do that and move away from them, assuming that the person isn't at risk, of course.
Yes.
One always has to, and you know, I've lived in that situation, so I know a little bit about that. But then the first thing obviously is to listen and to be present. And to be present, I think, as a reliable human being and somebody they trust. I think that's really, really important.
Yeah.
The next thing I think is you don't know how anyone else feels. Even if they've spent 3 years telling you what it feels to feel depressed, you don't know how they feel, you know? So that's the last thing you should say, or that you understand. I don't think that's right as well. I would be saying, how can I help? Of course, I'm here if you need me. I'll leave you alone, but remember, blah, 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 and keep in touch regularly. Maybe you don't live with the person. Maybe they live 20 miles away or 50 miles away and you speak to them on the phone or like this. But I think I would insist on reliability. You know, they may not want to speak to me every week if I'm a relative, but if that's what we've agreed, then feeling down isn't a reason not to stick to that commitment. That's what I'd say, although I understand that if they don't make it, in fact, if they don't make it for a phone call or a Zoom call, I might actually be relieved because, as I've said, it's not always a lot of fun. It can be hard work. So I think reliability is very, very important, and being present and asking how one can help. I would also, I think probably in my case, I'd be talking about, first of all, I think there's a lot of acceptance has to go with this. We have to accept the other person is feeling as they're feeling. But as I said to somebody quite recently, well, you just told me how you feel about this, and it's very, very hard for you. Supposing this is all there is. Supposing you were destined to spend the rest of your life like this. Now, I know this is counter-therapeutic, but I just wanted an answer to a question. Imagine that this is normal. You know, this is your new normal. Imagine that. How do you want to spend the rest of your life? You know, I know from being depressed when I lost somebody very dear to me. Twice in my life. I know from being depressed that I can still compartmentalize that and get on with my life. I feel depressed, but I also was lucky enough to know that there's a life beyond depression, probably because of what I do. So I would be asking about the life beyond depression in the person. Mm-hmm. You know, let's imagine that you could get over this. Let's imagine that you're feeling better. What is this stopping you doing now? What would you like to be doing? I wouldn't be interrogating them like that, but that's the kind of general conversation I would have. And the reason I would do that is I do not want to go in the conversation where they're already going in their head, which is why me, how bad is this, and all of that very natural stuff that you feel when you feel down. But I'm trying to have a different type of conversation with them, which is about where to from here.
Yes, absolutely. So incredibly inspiring and uplifting, actually, when you talk about this. So it's very uplifting to hear you talk about this, because you truly give the people and me as a listener and other people as a listener, as listeners, you give them the feeling of no matter how bad it gets for themselves or for people who they know that they're suffering with depression, if there is just one tiny glimpse of hope at the end of the tunnel, if you will, if they start imagining themselves even hypothetically as being able to get out of that position that can do incredible wonders for that. So Barry, this is fascinating listening to you talk about this. So thank you very much for that, of course. So I'm sure that our listeners are also, you know, holding on to your every word that you say, because it just feels so incredibly relatable. And especially because you have been also through this yourself, you know, like you have had also personal experiences with depression. So perhaps you can tell us more about that.
There are personal I mean, as a young man, I was probably depressed from the age of 16. I mean, people used to walk past me in the street and say, "Cheer up," total strangers, you know, because I've got one of those faces and I got a voice that's a bit down, you know. And I think that probably was in my life until I was certainly in my, I would say, my late 30s. When I had a crisis in my life, not the first one I'd had, but I had a crisis in normal life circumstances. And I eventually came out of what I would call that sort of dissociated depressive state. It wasn't with me all the time. I was functioning perfectly normally. But this is an interesting point. You know, you can have people who are suffering from depression who perform perfectly well in life. They just don't realize they're depressed, and that might be okay for them. That may not be a problem. But if it is a problem, we want to deal with the problem. We don't assume they're depressed. So, you know, I had that experience, and then it led me to a place in my life and activities in my life which eventually led me to what I do now. And I wish I could say I knew how I stopped being prone and vulnerable to depression.
Yeah.
But I don't. It's just that I live my way out of it. And but having said that, since my training and all of the experience I've had since then, and also I've been alive quite a long time, so I've had a lot of chance in my life to have a lot of things go wrong. You know, I've lost people tragically in some cases, and one has to weather these storms in life. So one of the things I would say about human beings is, you know, human beings have been on the planet forever, for however many millennia it is. And we haven't had psychology until 150 something years ago, somewhere around there, really in its present form. What did we have before then? We had the church. We had wise people in the village. We also didn't have, by the way, the incidence of depression that we have had in the last 70 years. It's just gone through the roof, but that's another story. So I'm a great believer in the resilience of the human spirit. And I think the best thing we can do as individuals, depressed or not depressed, is to remember that our ancestors, we came this far, you know, as a species. We came to dominate the planet, and we've survived because of our innate human skills, because of what it is to be human and social and to rely on each other and so forth. And you know, I might say, it may sound like I'm happy clappy and saying, go out and have fun and join up with other people. I'm actually the miserable person in the corner. I like my privacy. You know, I don't always want to go out and be with other people. I can be a solitary person or I can be a social person. So I'm not preaching a gospel of happiness or anything like that, but I'm saying that we have to rely that we are far more, each of us as an individual, stands on the shoulders of thousands of years of our ancestry, where we've been developed and developed and developed. And there is enough story, there are enough stories of success and survival in that for us to know that there is always possibility in our lives. There's always the possibility of something else. And if we can't solve the problem, somebody out there has solved it. And now, of course, with the internet, we can find people too. So that's very useful. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, I had two experiences, a great loss in my life, personal tragedy, and I'm not really going to go into those. But when I said, one of the things I learned the first time that happened was that routine was incredibly important to me. At that time, I had children at home. I had a dog that needed walking every day. So routine was very, very important to me because others counted on it, but actually it kept me going. And the other thing that I've learned, which I think is really, really important, as I've said, if you can imagine being in a boat rowing, I live near the sea. So you're rowing in a boat and the tide is trying to take you away from the shore and you keep rowing. And you notice that you're standing still. You're not going towards the shore yet, but you know the tide will change and you will get to the shore. So you're not in danger, but you're just not where you want to be yet. And that's how I think it is when you're in a bad place. That as long as you know you can reach the shore, you may not know how to do it yet, but you know the shore is there and that one day you can stand on that shore and look back. I think that's a very powerful thing to remember. And that certainly pulled me out of a deeper hole than I might otherwise have gone into.
Right.
So routine. And can I just say something about routine, which is very, very important, which is when I say routine, for example, I swim. So I swim every day that I can early in the morning. And I've done it for many, many years, 30, 40 years. I can't remember when I started. I don't swim in the morning because I feel like it. Because most days I'd rather stay in bed, if I'm honest. I swim in the morning because I swim in the morning. I swim in the morning because I have a routine. So my stuff is ready. I get up out of the house. I pick up my bag that I need with my stuff in it, and I go swimming. I don't think about it. But if you're suffering from depression, the problem is you'll start thinking about it. And I don't think I feel like going today. You know, and I know that if my wife and I say to each other, shall we go today, we'll end up not going. It's always nicer to have a cup of coffee or whatever. But in 30, 40 years of swimming, I've never, ever come out of the water and said, I wish I hadn't done that.
Right.
You know, right. So routine is incredibly important. Exercise is incredibly important. Keep moving is incredibly important. These things. And don't listen to the dangerous thoughts that are going to tell you all of that bad stuff because they're lying to you. Depression lies to you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So powerful and so deep of what you said. And I want to thank you also for bringing to the attention a very simple but incredibly powerful thing that we can all do, which is routine, as you just said. So how important is it for us to build a routine? If we don't have these routines that kind of keep us out of the dark, can we do this? Can we build the routine during depression, after depression? How can we get ourselves out of this?
Oh yeah, it's a really good question. And like most questions, I don't know the answer, but I'll work through it a bit. I mean, I think the thing is, I think about, you know, people often ask me about routine. And as I say, I don't have a standard answer. But I think the thing is, is there something in your life you used to do, even as a child, that you loved doing? This was some advice I was given fairly recently, and I just thought it was so useful. Is there something that you used to do that you loved doing? And turn back to that. Think about those things. Think about the things that used to give you pleasure, possibly things that you were good at. It might be athletics. It might be playing a musical instrument. It could be writing poetry. It doesn't matter. But to start to pick up on some of those things, because one of the things that depression does, I know this from my clients who suffer with depression. When I say to them, what do you do that gives you pleasure? They usually start the sentence with used to. I used to go to the gym, or when I'm not feeling like this, or I try. And I tell people, never try, just do it.
Yeah.
Because if I say I'm going to try, I'm really leaving a door open to not doing it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So just do it. So I don't, when I say routine, that can sound a bit frightening. Just one thing a day that gets you up and out of the house, maybe. Or if you have children and you have to be there, that gets you up, out of bed, you make the breakfast for the family, whatever it is you do. And don't think any further. Quite often people suffering from depression start to project this timeline ahead of them of hopelessness, and they will tell themselves why it's not going to work and why they can't do it. Just focus on the thing in front of you that you have arranged with yourself you will do. And if that's make a cup of coffee or a cup of tea or walk the dog or feed your cat or whatever it happens to be, water your plants, you know, something that is not you, that is actually engaging you in an activity.
Right. Absolutely beautifully said, Barry. And I think this is so incredibly impactful for so many people who are watching today talk. And if I may say, perhaps a silly thing is that, do you know that Nike's logo, the Nike's thing, they have a catchphrase, just do it. Perhaps this is precisely what we should do, not promoting Nike in general, but just like this reminded me of it. And it just perfectly fits what you said. Don't overthink.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't overthink. Mm-hmm. No, that's very good advice. Yeah. In fact, don't think at all if it's routine. Yeah. You know, the moment, because of the logic of depression, that thought will come into your mind with 63 reasons why you don't need to do it. Mm-hmm. And you just have to push that aside and just go past it. And if it is a routine, you won't think about it. You'll just do it because you do it.
Right. Just because you do it. There is no need for a reason, is it?
No.
Right.
And there is no need either to wait till you feel like it, because you'll never feel like it. If you're a sensible human being, nobody feels like going and knocking their brains out in the gym, or, you know, nobody feels like it. But after a time, you begin to miss it if you don't do it.
Right. And it's a good thing to keep on doing that, because you will reap rewards for it if you do it a certain amount of time, if it's over extended period of time. So, yeah, it just makes sense, Barry, what you just said. And if we honestly stop doing the things that we were supposed to do for our own good, even then we get even deeper in this trench of darkness, if you will.
Yeah. That's a risk. Yes, that's always a risk. As I said at the outset, you know, everybody is different and everybody will find their own ways of getting past that motivation trap, you know, of not feeling like they want to do something. Right. But something I often say to people who are suffering from depression, because they'll tell me things and they're just telling me what I do. You know, they say, oh, well, I get up in the morning and I don't feel like doing something. I say, well, I don't. You know, I once did a survey in some of my seminars. I did this over about a 2-year period. And I would ask the audience, you know, many hundreds of people sometimes, I'd say, how many people here have a job? And nearly everybody would put their hand up. And I'd say, and how many of you feel like going to work every day of the week? Maybe two hands would go up. And I'd say, how many feel like going to work 4 days, 3 days? You know, you can imagine. So eventually we wind up finding out that actually everybody has times of the week when they don't want to go to work. But the person who's suffering from depression, but they go to work anyway, you know. But the person who's suffering from depression uses that as a reason not to go. Well, what's wrong with going to work and being depressed and just get on and do your job, because you'll start to feel better? Now, that may sound a little hard line. I'm not that harsh with my clients, but that's where I'm coming from. If you stop and think about it, of course you won't want to do it. Nobody in their right mind wants to go to work every day. You know, we'd rather do other stuff. Yeah. And we all have bad days. But the difference between the person who becomes trapped and the person who doesn't isn't necessarily that they have something called depression. It's that they're believing what that mindset is telling them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think this is such a brilliant, incredible example that you just gave, because it is so incredibly relatable and it snaps you out of that overthinking mode. Because what you just said with job, do you go to job every day? Yes, I do. Even if you're impressed. So what if you went to the gym, or what if you went and, you know, go on about your day and do many useful good things for yourself? Brilliant, Barry. Brilliant. Now, I want to also ask you this question. Is it really important? And like, my question is, how would you recommend for people, or what would you recommend for people that are slow to get help? I know that we talked about this, but what would you recommend if people are slow to get help?
Well, I think the first thing is to realize that it's not you. It's not you. There's life beyond how you feel now. This isn't you. This is how you're feeling. But your thinking may be telling you it's you.
Yeah.
You know. And I would say something very important I don't mean it's important what I'm going to say, but an important factor that I've noticed, which is that mood disorders, depressive disorder, is encourages introspection, looking inside, asking myself questions, why me, etc. If I just knew, gosh, so many people say to me, if I just knew what was causing this. Well, the first thing is, let's not bother about what's causing it, because we'll never know, probably, in most cases. But people seem to think intuitively that if they can get an answer to that question, why, somehow they're going to be free of this negative feeling or these feelings. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. You can understand the cause of something and still feel terrible. You know, for example, we've just been through a pandemic. We know what was causing it. It was the virus. Understanding it didn't stop many people suffering in many ways. It's a clear example. So stop looking for the cause. Start thinking about how you want your life to be. Bypass the logic of depression. That's why I framed that expression, because if you can understand that your thinking is being distorted by the condition, if we call it that, and therefore we have to mistrust it and step outside it. Right. I'd also be looking for times in your life before or even currently. Even the most mm-hmm. depressed person has days where they function better than others. They have moments. It might be a 3-minute interaction with somebody on the street. It might be that they have a moment when they're not thinking about how bad they feel. They have a moment when they're able to do something that they couldn't do before, something like that. So yes. I'd be looking to build on those things.
Yes, absolutely. A beautiful, incredible answer. And so very, you know, ABCD, very practical, what you just said. So very beautiful, Barry. How can people actually find out more about you and more about your work?
Well, they can go to my website, www.barrywinbolt.com. That's Winbolt with an N. They can look on my blog. There are over 1,000 posts on there, and there's a lot on depression and working with depression. They can, through my blog, they can contact me, but they can also email me at info@barrywinbolt.com. I'm on LinkedIn. That's about it at the moment. I've mostly shed my social media presence because it's just such a waste of time for me. But I'm on LinkedIn as well, so they can find me there. I'm always happy to have a conversation about this. And, you know, I just think in the time that I've got left on Earth, I just want enough people to understand that we are incredibly resilient as a species. You don't have to suffer. And so if you are suffering, something's getting in the way, and you can do something about that.
Yes, yes.
Even absolutely. If you don't believe it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so incredibly much, Barry, for, you know, all of what you said. I'm sure that it helped a lot of people and also understand what they're going through and everything. So we've covered a lot today. So I really want to thank you very much for that and for being here with us. And to also remind our people listening to us today to, you know, click on the link below if you'd like to revisit this interview, because it has been fascinating. You do have the opportunity to do so. Please click the link right below because you can upgrade your participation over there and purchase an all access pass. And you can watch the Barry's and mine interview together that we did again. So thank you so very, very much for your attention, and I will see you in future interviews. Thank you.
Well, I'm really grateful for the questions. I thought you led the conversation in a really interesting way. This is a good example of what happens in a conversation, isn't it? Because I couldn't have had most of those thoughts had this interaction not been right. happening. So well, if people you. Take anything away, I hope they take away that, coming back to your earlier question, how powerful it can be speaking to somebody in the right sort of setting. So Monica, I'd like to say thank you to you as well. It's been a real privilege and a pleasure.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Get a Better Handle on Life. I hope you found today's episode informative and useful. If there was anything I missed or something you'd like to know more about, then please email me. I'd love to hear from you. You can subscribe to this podcast so you never miss an episode. It's available on all the usual platforms. And you can also find me on LinkedIn and on my website. Details are in the episode notes. And remember, life is a journey, and it's never too late to get a better handle on it. Thanks for listening. Speak to you soon, I hope. And this is it from me, Barry Winbolt. Over and out. Goodbye.